Yeah.
So you've already we'll do about 45 minutes from now.
Yeah, give me some more.
I'll probably just kind of well, let's go ahead and get started back to the last session of the day. First, before the talk, just to remind you that the conference dinner is at Aki's Indian restaurant on Waldenwood Wharf. Maybe you can describe better than me how to get there.
Okay. Is there anyone who's going who doesn't know where Waldenwood Wharf is? Okay. We can look after you, Greg, I think.
Okay.
Now, for people who do know where it is, I should point out that there's a very nice, very cool bar inside Waldenwood Wharf where you might want to, if you want a sort of pre-drink, dinner drink, that's a good place to go and have it. It was featured in Wallpaper magazine's list of top 10 cool bars of the world. It's associated with the hotel, which is called Blue. But there's only one, you simply walk in the big glass doors, and if you go into the hotel, go up the steps, and it's there. And it's inside the wonderful space inside the wall. And the restaurant is the first restaurant on the side of the wall. The one closest to the road.
And what time is it?
And dinner is at 7. And our table will be upstairs in the restaurant.
And there's the best place in Sydney to get a hot dog right before you get onto the wharf.
Yeah, but don't do that.
In case you don't eat Indian food. Okay, good. Well, with that announcement out of the way, let me introduce Greg Restall with a paper whose title is Too Big in My Eyes to Actually Be, but something not logical.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be able to give you a very light, non-technical talk, which is the only thing between you and the bar and the conference dinner. So let me first give you the outline. I'm going to talk about logical constants. People have talked about logical constants here already, so I'll say a little bit about that. Then I'm going to talk about a particular kind of rule which might be used to define a logical constant, which I'll call a defining rule. Then I'll wave my hands around in best something style and talk about making it explicit. We'll look at the easy cases, things like and, or, not, implies, and the quantifiers. And then we'll look at the slightly more interesting cases for the purposes of this workshop, modal claims, and I'll look at simple S5 metaphysical modality. And then for my next trick, we'll look at two-dimensional modal logic, and then I'll tell you what the hell all of that meant. So that's the outline of the talk. Let's start talking about logical constants. What's a logical constant? That's the question I'm going to be looking at for a little bit. Well, a logical constant, presumably, is logical. And it's constant. What on earth does that mean? Well, some things people have said about logical constants are that they're subject matter independent. You know, when I'm saying things involving and, or, and not, you know, it's not like I'm particularly talking about, you know, fish or fowl or cabbages or kings or rules or what. I can talk about anything using and, or, and not, and the quantifiers. That's one thing that people use. Another thing about this is it's definable. We can give their meanings in such a way that there's going to be no disagreement about how the things work relative to that way of giving their meanings, in some sense. There can be argy-bargies about what the proper logic of not are, what the proper logic of and implication and all of those things might be, but relative to some proposal about that, there's no disagreement. Whereas relative to some proposal about, you know, how red works, there can still be disagreements about whether or not something is red. It doesn't seem to be the same kind of way with logical constants. Another thing about logical constants is the kinds of roles that they use, that they're used for. Things like and, or, not, implies, quantifiers, these kinds of things, play a structural role in deduction when we're reasoning. These kinds of logical particles seem to play a very, very important role. You see them again and again and again. And another sense, the relation of logical consequence that you get out of this is in some sense necessary. You know, when I'm looking at models of logical languages or models of the way that the logical constants work, they're not meant to rule out any possibilities. So if something is preserved over all of these, then it's got to be necessary. You're not leaving out any salient possibilities like this. And there are paradigm cases. And or not implies the quantifiers. So is there an understanding of how to carve the boundary between the logical and the non-logical which can respect these kinds of considerations? And when you do this, how does modality, how do things like it's necessary that, or can capability operators and things like this, epistemic modals, all of these things, where do they fit in that kind of boundary? That's what I'm going to be looking at. So let's look at the issue of boundary drawing when it comes to logic. When you're going to draw a boundary using logic, you know, the ways that logicians come about doing these things fall into two different kinds. We've got this boundary between the valid and the invalid argument. And whenever we draw a fence down conceptual space like this, you can draw it from either side, as it were, the good side or the bad side, the red side or the blue side. You can think of something, green side, sorry, not blue, that's, I'm not blue-green colorblind. You could think of drawing this boundary positively or negatively. You can draw it negatively by carving out the space of invalid arguments by saying these are the ones which are refuted by models. An argument from premises to a conclusion is invalid if there's some model interpretation which makes the premises true and the conclusion false. And this will count as a counterexample. And so the validities are the things which are preserved over all of these things. And so the tautologies are the things which are true in every model, and the non-tautologies are the things which have counterexamples in some models. So if I give you a model, that's a witness to something being invalid. It's a counterexample. And model theory is one way of drawing this kind of boundary. On the other hand, you can draw the boundary on the positive side. You can say, look, if an argument is valid, then I can hear is something which witnesses its validity. This is a proof from the premises to the conclusion. And so something is invalid if it ain't got one of those. So this is a very different way of drawing the kind of boundary. And the neat thing about logic is that you can walk both sides of the street. You know, we teach people how to do this. We teach people proof theory. We teach people model theory. And you're meant to go, here we go. In a nice, well-behaved picture, the two ways of drawing the boundary carve at exactly the same spot. This is what a soundness and completeness theorem is for. Now, these kinds of technologies, these kinds of ways of doing logic are applied for nefarious or not so nefarious semantic purposes by other people. So you could say these kinds of models that we use to define counterexamples due to Tarski, due to Kripke structures for modal logics, Montague semantics, all of these kinds of things can be used not only for drawing distinctions between valid and invalid, but in giving semantic accounts of how bits of language work or how concepts work. And then using those ways of understanding the logical, non-logical boundary and the validity-invalidity boundary, people pick out the logical constants by saying that these are the things which are somehow, you know, preserved over all of these classes of models, a structure invariant or something like this. You get these permutation conditions due to Tarski originally, and other people like Sol Pfefferman and other people, Guy Lecher, other people like this, propose that an item of vocabulary is a logical constant if, you know, its interpretation is invariant under particular kinds of transformations of these models. That's one way you could do this. Okay? But another way that you could do this is by trying to do the boundary on the other side using proof theory. And what do proof theory things look like? Things like natural deduction, sequent calculus, these kinds of things. And then logical constants are the things which are given rules which have nice proof theoretical properties in some way. And because the kinds of philosophers and semantics people who hang about workshops like this are the kinds of people that are interested in normative, pragmatic, expressivist kinds of things, they tend to not focus on using the models for giving explanatory work, especially when it comes to modal logic and saying that, you know, Kripke models tell you what these kinds of things mean, because presumably they only tell you what these kinds of things mean if you know what the things in them actually are. And it seems like that's getting the direction of explanation wrong when it comes to the modals. We don't know what modal operators do in terms of possible worlds. We understand what possible worlds are in terms of what's possible. People hear much, you know, people like Bob and people like other people, people like Dummett, people like other people that are interested in non-truth conditional, non-representational accounts of semantics like this side of the street. So I'm going to look at this. Now, the problem of... this is just saying that, you know, qua logician, I like looking at both sides of the street because I think one of the, you know, conceptual highlights of 20th century work in, you know, one of the greatest advances in the 20th century was the soundness and completeness theorems, which say that these two different ways of drawing boundaries come to the same thing. It was a conceptual insight to realize, my goodness, they're actually drawing the boundaries in a different way, and then to prove that even though they drew the boundary in, drew boundaries in a different way, they drew them in the same place. You know, the work of Gödel and Tarski and others in making that clear, I think, was a massive conceptual insight. The soundness and completeness theorem can be understood as proving two things. Soundness tells you that there's no overlap between the green and the red areas. You know, if a proof system tells you that something is valid, then there shouldn't be a counterexample to it. And completeness should tell you the other, that there's no gap between these two things. For every argument, you're either going to have a proof or you're going to have a countermodel. Okay. So qua logician, I think both of these things are deeply important. Qua person who's interested in semantics and the philosophical questions around here, there's a really interesting question as to which of these ways of understanding things is going to give you the kind of explanation that you want. Now, I think that both proofs and models can play a role in semantics and can connect issues in meaning together with issues of how language works in various ways. Both of the, often when you hear people talk about logic, they think of, you know, semantics, that means model theory, and, you know, proof theory is mere syntax. That clearly can't be right, because if it was right, then, you know, why the hell is it that there's a different proof rule for and as it is for or? I mean, unless there's a difference in what and or means. Okay, so there's a connection, at least, between proof theory and semantics. The issue is whether that should be always explained through model theory or always explained through proof theory or sometimes different strokes for different folks or different questions, different answers for different questions. So, proofs are good for accounts which are connected with use in some way, because deriving things, inferring things, a whole bunch of things like that, proofs tend to be finitary, and they tend to be the kinds of things which are at least traceable and trackable and connected with use. And so if you're interested in connecting semantic issues with use, proofs look like a really good place to look. Gerhard Gentzen, table tennis. That's a picture. I don't know which direction the ball is going. Pardon? He cut the ball. Ah, very good. Cut. That's this one. It's also called schnitt, right there. Okay, that's cut. There's Gentzen. That's Gentzen's proof theory for classical logic. It's all very obvious and clear. How might we use this for defining rules for connectives, for logical concepts and everything? Well, let's have a look. We'll immediately start having a look by looking at the most clear presentation of the problem of using the kinds of rules that we have. Let's go back to these rules. If you look down here, these are the kinds of rules that you might think tell you something about how AND works. You know, the UES, I can't even remember what UES stands for, but this says that, you know, if you want to derive a conjunction from some premises and other stuff, then derive both of the conjuncts to do that. And if you want to show that something follows from a conjunction, well, one way to do that is show that it follows from the first conjunct, and another way to do it is show it follows from the second conjunct. That's the UEA rule. And so on for or and not and things like this. And there seems to be something really compelling about the idea that, you know, if you do your inference or constrain your interpretation of and or like this, then you're going to coordinate with other people who do that in the same kind of way. You're going to grasp what it means. There's nothing more to and or than that. That was a plausible idea for many people. And Arthur Pryor, pixelated Arthur Pryor, in his paper, The Runabout Inference Ticket, said, well, if you reckon that inference rules can define a concept, How about this? Well, this one, this looks good. These inference rules look like they do define and. Well, how about this one? These inference rules, from A to derive A tonk B and from A tonk B to derive B, let me introduce into my conceptual apparatus tonk. This has a great virtue, does tonk, of being able to shorten the proof of anything. Okay? If you want to know how to prove Q from P, maybe the shortest proof you used to have was really, really long. Now it has a two-line proof. P from P by tonk introduction to derive P tonk Q from tonk elimination to derive Q. So now you can derive Q from P, so that's excellent. Huh. Right, well, maybe you don't want to derive Q from P. Maybe that's not the job. So just presenting some rules and saying they define concepts is clearly not going to be sufficient. And in the literature responding to Pryor's paper came again and again and again, lots of different proposals which said, well, not every posited collection of rules is going to be enough. The collection of rules that are posited for some or which are introduced or proffered for some concept have got to be well-behaved in some particular way. Now, what might those be? Well, your favourite logician and mine, Newell, in a response to the paper, the very nicely titled Tonk, Plonk and Plink, said, well, look, the neat kind of thing about conjunction is that the rules for conjunction satisfy a number of interesting properties. They're conservative and they're uniquely defining, and the rules for tonk aren't. It's conservative in the sense that if you've got a logical vocabulary and you add the rules for and, then under certain conditions, certain very, not hard to state, but I'm not going to go through those now, conditions, you're not going to be able to derive anything in the old vocabulary using the new rules that you couldn't already derive in the old vocabulary using whatever the old rules were. You'll be able to derive new things, things involving and. And maybe your old vocabulary didn't have and maybe that'd be really useful to have and. So you'd be able to do new stuff, but the new stuff won't infect the old stuff. It will be conservative in that sense. And it's uniquely defined because if Bob introduces and using the and rules, and I introduce and using the and rules as well, then what Bob means by and what I mean by and are going to somehow be coordinated. Because if I introduce and using Bob's, if Bob, likes an ampersand for and I like a wedge for and we both introduce the rules using rules of the same shape but different syntax, then it's going to turn out that they're interderivable. His and can be derived from mine, and mine can be derived from his, because I can go from my A and B to derive A, and my A and B to derive B, and then from the A and the B to derive Bob's A and B, using my and eliminations and his and introductions, and vice versa. So the rules are uniquely defining. We coordinate. That's really neat, and you can't do that with tonk. Tonk's not conservative, because now you can go from P to Q, where you couldn't before. So this is a really neat insight, and it's relative to your starting point. The idea is that whether or not something counts as logical for Bob, for Newell's analysis here, is always relative to where you started. Relative to language one, adding conjunction is conservative and uniquely defining. Whereas maybe to language one, tonk is not going to be conservative and uniquely defining if in language one I couldn't derive an arbitrary Q from an arbitrary P. Now, if I had a very odd degenerate linguistic practice according to which I could derive anything from anything, then tonk would be conservative. And by goodness, it would be uniquely defining, because in fact, in that context, anything is uniquely defining because you can derive anything from anything. But anyway, so tonk would be okay there, relative to that degenerate practice. Now, maybe that's not too bad, but what would be really nice is to understand whether there was a kind of absolute notion of logicality. Partly because, those model theorists have got what looks like an absolute notion of logicality. It'd be nice to have one here too. And secondly, it looks like the kind of logicality that we have for things like the good old classical rules for and or and not seem to be really robust in a particular way that we'd like to understand. And that's what I'm going to look at now. Is there an absolute notion? And we're going to do that by waving our hands around and talking about things being made explicit. So here's a book. It makes many, many things explicit. Let's have a look at how the rules for and might actually... So we're going to take some work of Bob's on how logical vocabulary makes explicit what is implicit in our discursive practices. And I'm going to abuse that and apply it in a particular proof theoretical context. If you look at these rules for and, it's not obvious how they make explicit what's implicit in our discursive practice, but if we replace these rules for and for the sequent calculus rules for and that were in Ganson's case, it's looking a little bit kind of closer. These rules kind of say that if I can derive a... If I can derive y from A and B together with other premises x, then you could also derive y from A and B rather than from A and from B. You know, if I use A and B in my deduction, then instead of incurring the two assumptions A and B, I could just derive it from the single conjunctive assumption A and B. And then the other rule says that if I can derive A and I can derive B, then I can jam them together and derive A and B. This is left and right rules in a sequent calculus. Now, a neat thing, I'm not going to go through the proof theory about this because, hey, it's late and we want to go to the bar. The neat thing about this is that those two rules can be collapsed relative to the structural rules of cut and identity into one single two-way defining rule, which says that a conjunction on the left, a conjunction used as a premise, is equivalent to the two conjuncts being used as a premise. This is the left rule, which is the proof theoretical formal definition for this, is that the left rule is invertible. And in fact, the right rule is defined from the left rule read in reverse. If I can derive y from A and B separately, then I can derive y from the single conjunctive premise A and B, and vice versa. Now, if you take that to be a defining rule for conjunction, my God, it looks like you are making explicit something that is implicit. You're making explicit in a single assertion the joint assertion of the two premises, A and B. Now, why the hell would you want to do that? Why? I mean, it's not actually economy of expression, after all, because saying A and saying B doesn't take a hell of a lot longer than saying A and B. In fact, it might take something slightly less because there's one more word when you say and. Okay. But one reason for this is that because then if you say A and B and I think that there was a mistake that you made, I can say, no, you're wrong by saying, no, not A and B, without denying A and without denying B, because I can just think that you made a mistake in saying A and B together without being able to isolate the mistake into denying A and denying B. Because now, when you make explicit as a single assertion, the assertion A and B is something which can then be dealt with in the way that you deal with other assertions, by denying it, by making it the antecedent in the conditional, or the consequent in the conditional, or all of the other wonderful embedded things that make expressivists have problems. Okay. That's the job that it does. Once you make explicit in our vocabulary something that was implicit in our practice, and it's a very basic thing which is implicit in our practice, namely that assertion doesn't just stop with making one of them, then you can do something that you couldn't do before. Okay, but once you do that trick, there it is, that's the slogan. Logical notions have definitions. It is a definition because if you do that twice, it's uniquely defining. If we use that rule once for an ampersand and once for a wedge, then they're interderivable. That's one thing. It makes definition, which makes explicit something which is implicit in our discursive practice, or discourse. Now, this kind of rule provides coordination. Oh, my goodness, that's what I was going to say. That's ampersand and the wedge. They're completely interdefinable. Now, it also gives you what Noor wanted in terms of conservative extension, at least in many, many cases. I'm not going to go through that. That's Ganson's cut elimination argument. Don't worry about that. That's very too much to do at 20 past 5. So we won't do that. So, next section, the easy cases. We've already done and. There was a rule for and. That's got a defining rule which makes explicit what's implicit in our discursive practice. How about that? Here's a rule for or. It's exactly the same, except it's on the other side. Now, how does that work? Because it's not like saying asserting a disjunction makes explicit what's involved in asserting either of the disjuncts, because I can assert A or B without asserting A and without asserting B. Well, you know, what's happening on the right-hand side of the turnstile in a proof system is the conclusion. And, well, I'm going to say a little bit more about this in a tick once I've gone through all of the rules, but one way you can understand this is that this says that denying A or B has the same normative force as denying A and denying B. So if you want to read the stuff on the sequent positively, it says that, you know, if all of the premises are true, then some of the conclusions are true. Or don't ever get yourself in a position where you assert all of the left-hand bits and deny all of the right-hand. So disjunction could be defined in the same kind of way. More interesting, too, is negation. You know, it makes explicit what side of the turnstile you're on. It swaps. It says that asserting a negation has got the same normative force as denying the thing negated. Very equally, you could use the definition in the other direction and say that denying a negation has the same force as asserting the thing negated. And those two things would be equivalent in this context. Get to that. More fun is the conditional as well. It kind of says that denying a conditional has the same force as asserting the premise and denying the conclusion. It's a material conditional. It's not very powerful, but there it is. More interestingly yet are the quantifiers, which are interesting because they use a different bit of vocabulary, the distinction between you know, the judgments and the singular terms. Once you've isolated a grammatical category of a grammatical and semantic category of singular terms, then we can say, look, denying a universally quantified expression has got the same force as being prepared to deny an instance of it. Now, that's not any particular instance of this, but being able to introduce in your vocabulary a name and being prepared to cop the denial of the instance of the universally quantified expression. If you deny that all frogs are green, then we can say, oh, well, let's name a non-green frog. Let's Kermit. That's probably a bit confusing calling it Kermit, and that's why we've got the bit which says that, you know, the name that we add is not one that we've got other commitments about. I know Kermit's green. I also know Kermit isn't a frog, which is what's very confusing. Kermit's a puppet. But anyway, there it is. We won't go into the details of that. It just all works. Okay? These are all, you know, every logical constant in the classical propositional predicate case has got invertible defining rules like this. Now, what's interesting for semantic purposes is to ask ourselves the question, what the hell do these rules latch onto? You know, just because they're a whole bunch of formal rules, which have got interesting formal properties, what has that got to do with semantics? Well, the story that I like is in this paper called Multiple Conclusions, which says, oh, look, if I've got a proof or a sequent derivation which goes from X to A, let's just look at the many premises single conclusion case. That shows us why it would be a mistake, and a really bad mistake, to assert all of the X's and deny A. So, you know, it doesn't say that you should derive A from X, because maybe you were stupid to assert all of the A's, right? Okay. But it at least tells you that, you know, if you get yourself in a position where you're committed to each of the A's and you deny each of the X's and you deny the A, well, that's wrong. And so why should you infer A? Well, at least A is undeniable. That seems like as good a reason as any. Once you realize that you've got that kind of reading from many premises to a single conclusion, then it's a very small jump from many premises to many possible conclusions in the sequent calculus reading. And we say that, look, what a derivation tells you of X turnstile Y is that it's out of bounds in some strong sense to assert all of the X's and deny all of the Y's. And then proofs can be understood as a way of making explicit, using these kinds of defining rules, norms governing assertion and denial. So a discourse has a score, where the score keeps track of, you know, how we're going to evaluate what's going on so far, and at the very least what we want to keep track of is what's been asserted and what's been denied. And then various kinds of moves add things to the assertion or to the denial box. Various other kinds of moves, like retraction, saying, my God, I was wrong, are withdrawing things from various boxes as you go. Okay? And defining rules show how we can score new moves in the game, in the practice, in terms of how we scored the old rules. Okay? That's the idea here. So I won't go through this. It's all a bit scary. But here's a rule of, you know, the classical De Morgan law. Ooh. Get all the way over there, you little thing. classical De Morgan law, if A and B is false, then either not A or not B. And you can think of this as, you know, up the top here, there's a very simple basic norm, the rule of identity, which says, you know, you'd be a bit stupid to assert and deny A at the same time. That's where the identity rule comes in. And then we use the defining rule for not, which says that, you know, A on one side becomes a not A on the other, B on one side becomes a not B on the other, then rule for or and so on, which says the basic fundamental incoherence of the ban on, you know, the job of assertion and denial is for either to, you know, count against one another, ruling out of bounds, asserting and denying something at the same time in the same part of the practice, then the other rules just say, well, you know, we're going to treat these more complex expressions in terms of the way the more simple expressions do. And using those rules, you get down to the conclusion which says, oh, look, you know, don't get yourself in a position where you assert that the conjunction's not true and deny that this disjunction, and not A or not B, and so on. And the little scary, you know, diagram on the right is a way of representing that directly in terms of a proof where you go from things to other things, but I won't do that here. Okay, so the structural rules, the scary bits here, you know, Schnitt and other things like that, tell you something about norms governing assertion and denial as such, where there's no specification of the content of or the structure of the things being asserted and denied. The cut rule is kind of interesting. This is the one which says that, oh, look, if stuff on the... Oh, there you go. Reading it from bottom to top, it says that if gamma and delta... You know, from bottom to top, think about it like this. If it's okay to... If it's in bounds to assert gamma and delta and deny theta and lambda, then it would also be okay either for one of the other two things to hold, that you add D to the denial side or that you add D to the assertion side. Because conversely, if it was out of bounds to assert a D and it's out of bounds to deny D, then, that would kind of be bad. Then the incoherence is actually to be sheeted home to the other stuff that you were doing. Now, why is that the case? Well, you can think about it like this. If you're in an okay position and it's out of bounds to add A to the denial box, then it's undeniable relative to the position that you've got. And, well, what's assertion but making explicit the undeniability of something? Or what's if the job of denial and assertion is to stand against each other in this kind of way, then if something is undeniable, then to assert it is just to make that explicit, and if something is unassertable, then to deny it is to make that explicit. And you can say the same kinds of things for the other structural rules. That was a hard one. Then you can understand these sequent rules, the connective rules, as ways, if you understand them in the defining way that I was talking about, as ways of making aspects of the scorekeeping score sheet explicit in the actual content, like where you are left, where you are right, the way that names work and all of that kind of stuff. And so this connects semantics with normative pragmatics, where I think of semantics proof theoretically. Okay. And so the boundary between being logical and non-logical is determined then by two choices. One choice is, well, what is the space of scores that we are able to trade off on? Is it just asserting and denying stuff and these kinds of sequence? Well, if it is that, then you can define things using the classical propositional and maybe predicate logic of judgments have got this form where you can abstract out singular terms in particular ways. Maybe if they've got other richer structures, you can have other rules which exploit those kinds of structures. So there's one question about what is this phenomenon that we're defining things in terms of, and then given that, what kind of vocabulary are you actually going to define? Okay. Simple modality. Now, if a proof from X to Y shows us how a position in which each of the X's are asserted and each Y is denied is out of bounds, then we can notice that, well, assertion and denial don't have to be flat. We've been talking about this implicitly, at least, and a little bit explicitly earlier in this workshop. I can assert or deny under a supposition. Okay, an assertion of I'm in Sydney clashes with its denial. No, I'm not. Okay. On the other hand, an assertion of I'm in Sydney doesn't clash with its denial, where that denial is under the scope of something like suppose I couldn't get here. If I ask you to suppose something else, then, Greg wouldn't be in Sydney, he'd still be in Melbourne. That doesn't clash with actually claiming that Greg is in Sydney. I haven't contradicted myself then. Even though, when I say, oh, Greg's in Melbourne, not in Sydney, do our reasoning about that, I can do lots of reasoning using various facts that I know about the location of Sydney and Melbourne and all of these other kinds of things, but it doesn't clash with this assertion that I've made over in this bit of the discourse that I am actually in Sydney. Okay? And we can hold both of those things at the same time and reason with them at the same time in the one dialogue. Okay? So, modal discourse is filled with things like this, and sometimes these shifts are just said by saying things like suppose. Sometimes they're flagged when we say, oh, he can do this. My God, what would happen were he to do this? Well, then, etc., etc. And sometimes they're filled with flowery, metaphysically interesting things like, consider a possible world in which. Ooh, okay, away we go. So why not take this into account in the score sheet? That's the plan. Why not? Let's do it. If x turns to y tells us that it'd be a mistake to assert x and deny y, roughly speaking, then let's say x turns to y, bar, u turns to v, says that it'd be a mistake to assert x and deny y in some bit of the discourse and assert u and deny v in another bit of the discourse where we used a supposed shift to get from one to the other. Okay, and the formal structure, this has been studied in proof theory for a while, although it's only been recently that people have realized that it's got that kind of interpretation. So it's called a hypersequent. Why is it a hypersequent? Because it's like a sequent except more. At least I didn't call it a supersequent or something like that, or a sequent pro or something. Hypersequents are really good for modal logics. Now, here's a defining rule. Defining rule which says, look at this. It's just kind of like the universal quantifier rule, which people have kind of noticed. If you deny that A is necessary, then you should be prepared to cop opening up a supposition where you deny A. Now, you don't actually deny A, but if I deny that A is necessary, then there can't be anything incoherent, ruled out in my commitments, if I open up a possibility in which I deny A. In the same way that if I deny that all frogs are green, if you can show an incoherence when I add to my vocabulary a term to name some non-green frog. And if you can show that that's inconsistent, then that's inconsistent with my denial that all frogs are green. It's exactly the same kind of logical structure, except that no names are involved. We're just going to open up a bit of the discourse. We're going to say, well, I suppose not A, and see how we go. And you can treat this as a defining rule for necessitation. Formally speaking, what you get when you do this, well, you can unpack it into a left rule and a right rule, and my God, what do you get? What do you get? What you get is the modal logic S5, my God, when you do it like this, which is kind of hard to get a proof theory for modal logic S5. Here's a little bit about how it works. You know, you don't assert A and deny A. Well, that means you don't, you know, assert that A is necessary and then deny A in some other bit of the discourse. Okay? There's a clash there. If I assert that A is necessary and consider another circumstance and deny A, well, that's the point of A being necessary. So that's how I get the second line over here. And same for the line over there, box B and B on the other side of the slash. And then I can just introduce a conjunction, and that's just a good old standard conjunction rule. You know, I've derived A and I've derived B, and just pile together the things I assumed to derive A and derive B. It doesn't matter that they were in another bit of the discourse. And then we've just got a comma on the left over here, so that becomes a conjunction just using the defining rule for AND. And my God, because, you know, A and B is undeniable in an arbitrary context, that means that it's undeniable that it's necessary that A and B. So we can derive a necessity of a conjunction from the necessity of both of its conjuncts. Just using this kind of discourse analysis of how box works. And you get not only, you know, the things of a normal modal logic, but it turns out to be S5 for those of you that care about this. And not a possible world in sight. Neat thing about, well, maybe there is a possible world inside. Maybe this tells you what it is to see possible worlds, in fact. But neat thing about this is that it expands. Because, well, there are these different bits of discourse, right? But some of them are actually reflecting of the things that you actually committed to. You know, once you say, well, different bits of the discourse, then maybe we should flag one of them and say, this is the one where you started from, where you weren't buggering about and talking about other possibilities. Well, let's flag that with a little subscript actuality thing. And let's have another bit of vocabulary which makes explicit where the hell you are. so that asserting in some zone of the discourse, actually I, has got the same normative force as asserting I back where you started. And that gives you the rules for actuality in standard brand S5 modal logic with actuality. And we're on our way to two-dimensional modal logic when we do this. So, thing to notice is stuff that people have mentioned. I've got no idea how this works in natural language, but you'll notice I don't care because I'm a logician. And that's all right. I don't care. I mean, I do care. Of course I care deeply. But I've already, you know, taken my lumps and realized that or in natural language is nothing like vel, really, and not in natural language is nothing like, you know, all of the examples that we have about, you know, the pidgin English and the modal operators. You know, just teach first-year logic, you realize that there's pidgin English when logicians have to keep on saying, it is not the case that, for that little tilde thing that we use for negation. This is an idealization. And the reason that this is an idealization is because we're after things that we can give nice, precise rules for because, well, in some circumstances, it's really good to have nice, precise rules. Like where we want to know whether the hell an argument is valid or not. It's nice to know what the rules of the game are. So I don't care. Oh, I do care. But it's a different kind of care. Same here. Now, I think there are two different kinds of shift. Now, how this comes out in language and our conceptual capacities and everything like that is a very interesting thing and one that I'm really, really interested in. It looks like, logically speaking, there are two different kinds of shift which are involved, which are have been called things like indicative and subjunctive shift, and these are connected to different kinds of capacities that we have. We can sometimes do shifts where we do introduce a scope in the a supposition, where I'm saying, well, suppose I'm wrong. You know, well, suppose this is actually the case. Well, no, I think this is the case, but suppose I'm wrong. Let's figure it out. And then there's the subjunctive shift, which is, well, suppose things go differently, or suppose we decide this. And the logic of how this works is interesting. If we, you know, people have looked about, I don't know how long people have talked about the difference, but presumably it's at least since the assassination of Kennedy. Right? Maybe this is why, because people started saying, you know, if Oswald didn't shoot JFK, well, let's suppose Oswald didn't shoot JFK. Et cetera. Still got a hole in the back of his head, you know, got shot. Wasn't him, was someone else. Suppose Oswald hadn't shot JFK. You know, the logic of that seems to be kind of different. Now, I reckon that there's something important which is going on here, and this is due to these, it's not actually due to these two fine people. One of these two fine people is Mark Lanz. The other of these two fine people is Zachary Restall, my son. You can't quite see in the back there. Oh, no, that's Mark. In the back there, there is a Tasmanian devil. But it's black, and it's in the black anyway. Mark Lanz and his collaborator in this paper, Heath White, which is extremely grand rhetoric about person's freedom and two spaces of material inference and stereoscopic vision and all of that kind of stuff, say that, well, hang on. And this is a point that's been made in various contexts around here as well, is that the distinction between indicative and subjunctive supposition or shifts in discourse are independently motivated for kinds of creatures like us who act on the basis of our views, right? Because what we want to do is we want to act and consider what would happen were I to do this or what would happen were I to do that. We want to do that. Certainly want to plan. And we want to plan on the basis of our views because our views are guiding our actions. And we want to, you know, run some deduction and do some stuff on the basis of actions that we might make. But we also want to correct our beliefs. We also want to, well, hang on, I might realize that Bob believes something and I think that's crazy. Why would he believe that? And we might argue about that and I might say, suppose you're right and look at the consequences of what it is that you believe. And I might want to import some of the things that I believe in that kind of discourse, but I don't necessarily import all of them because one of the things that I believe is that he's wrong. So I open up another bit of the discourse. Well, I say, well, I suppose I'm wrong, suppose you're right, and away we go. And that's a very different kind of thing with similar structures, but not the same. Okay, I've been warned that I've got to stop very soon, so let's keep going. This structure grounds a system for two-dimensional modal logic for necessity and a priori nobility. This is a logician's idealization. There's a whole bunch of contextual stuff that goes in about, you know, how we change things. But you know, what logicians are really good at, just like with the universal quantifier, you know, the logician's universal quantifier is not really useful when we say all the beer is here or anything like this. There's lots of contextual restrictions. But when I say all the beer as a logician, I mean all the beer. And when I say, you know, universal quantification over these kinds of contexts, I mean arbitrary contexts. So let's just turn the dials up to 11 and see how they go. Neat thing about this is even though there's structural similarities, they're different, which can be motivated by the roles in terms of planning and update of belief. Here's some good inferences and bad inferences, where I use APK for a priori knowability. That's indicative shifts turned up to 11, and box is subjunctive shifts turned up to 11. This inference on the left is good. If A equals B, then it's necessary that if FA, then FB. Why? Because if Hesperus is Phosphorus and I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen if I plan a trip to Hesperus, that's planning a trip to Phosphorus, right? Okay. If I want to know what happens if I'm going to have a beer with Bono, that is having a beer with Paul Hewson. And this is a good inference. Whereas, if Hesperus is identical to Phosphorus, it doesn't mean that in every possible context where I'm revising all of my beliefs, that Hesperus is identical to Phosphorus, because maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Hesperus isn't identical to Phosphorus. I can be wrong about identity claims. So the logic of this, you know, it's incoherent to assert that A is identical to B and assert FA and deny FB in a subjunctive alternative thing. That's a very plausible fundamental rule about subjunctive alternativeness, and it's completely implausible when it comes to indicative alternativeness. On the other hand, when it comes to actuality, you know, I can know a priori that if P is the case, then it's actually the case. It's obvious, right? Because the way indicative alternativeness goes, when I consider an indicative alternative, I'm considering another way that things could actually be, as far as I know, or even arbitrarily, not as far as I know, unlimitedly. So the rule of indicative alternativeness is it takes you into another context, which is subscripted by the actuality operator, whereas subjunctive alternativeness isn't. It's not necessary that if P is the case, then it's actually the case, because, of course, you know, it's not necessary that you know, if I'm in Sydney, then I'm actually in Sydney. Or if I'm in Melbourne, then I'm actually in Melbourne, because there's a big possibility that I'm not in Sydney, that I am in Melbourne, but I am actually in Sydney. So what's wrong with this deduction? Well, this rule here, you know, to derive that something is necessary, you don't want to just derive it in every actual context. This isn't an instance of the box rule, whereas the corresponding thing over there is an instance of the a priori knowability rule. So I'm going to stop by saying, oh, there's a paper where I go through all of the proof theory of this and all of the technical stuff, if you like, lots of chicken scratches. The upshot is this. These rules are conservative and uniquely defining. They satisfy the kind of criteria. What that means is that if the score sheet has got this kind of stuff, if it's got this variegation, then that we can be parasitic on, that our rules can, you know, feed off, as it were. If we agree on what indicative and subjunctive shifts occur in a discourse, then we can coordinate on the way that those things work, in just the same way that we can coordinate on and or and not. We can coordinate on the meaning of box, even though we don't agree on the truth value of box sentences. You might think that God's existence is necessary and I might not. Doesn't matter. But that doesn't mean we don't agree, because after all, we can agree on the meaning of and without agreeing on the truth value of every and sentence. It's exactly the same thing. Okay? The modal concepts arise freely from the structures in our discourse in exactly the same way that and arises freely out of, you know, joint assertion and stuff like that. And the rules show us how these modal things are grounded in the practices that we have. But now these are the practices of different kinds of supposition. And the rule tells us how to reason with these things. At least these are just logicians' idealizations of what are the more interesting practical things. But because these rules are precisely defined, that can show how that we can reason with these things and possibly answer questions about modal epistemology. Because now, at least, we've got, you know, rules which tell you stuff in exactly the same way that we can tell you how to reason with universal quantifier, which is going to be helpful when it comes to epistemology of generality claims. And I think this actually tells you something about possible worlds as well, but that's the completeness proof, and I won't say anything more about that. So I won't say anything about modal ontology. Thank you very much.
Doesn't seem to come out a priori by your rule, at least, because it's not theorem of logic than there are infinitely many primes. See, there's no of logicism. So the worry is that you're giving me rules that are a bit like giving the conjunction rules for because. There's something missing. A because B tells A and B, but there's much more to because than just conjunction. And similarly, there seems to be much more to a priority than provability. And the rest, I don't quite see where it is in your picture. Or same for subjunctive necessity, of course, where again, I would have thought it's necessary that there are infinitely many primes, but I can't see how your rules give me that.
Good, these are good questions. Firstly, it's not like the analogy with because isn't good, because I could... These rules are invalid for because. You know, the and introduction rule on the right is invalid. So that doesn't work. Of course, these rules don't tell you why it's a priori that there are infinitely many primes, because these rules, as they go so far, don't tell you anything about the meaning of is prime or the meaning of there are infinitely many. And the way that this will work is, you know, these rules don't enable you to prove that there are infinitely many primes because this is a logic that I'm telling you so far, and the logic by itself only gives you semantic story for a certain number of expressions, and it doesn't tell you anything about the semantics of infinitely many and primes and everything like this. But once you add those, then there's going to be a question. What's going to follow from that? I mean, I could have done all of this truth conditionally, and it still wouldn't have given you a theorem that there are infinitely many primes, because all that would tell you is, you know, there are, you know, lambda many f's. That's the logical form of that. And we don't want that there are lambda many f's to be a theorem, but we do want there are infinitely many primes to be true, and it's a priori knowable that there are infinitely many primes to be true. So the explanation of how that works is going to tell me is going to involve something about, you know, claims of arithmetic and whether those things are the things which are not only true but a priori knowable. And the positive story that I would then tell is say, well, let's look at the semantics of arithmetical claims. You know, it's undeniable that, you know, every number has a successor, that's correct, but is it undeniable under the scope of any of these other kinds of supposition changes? Well, by God, yes it is, because we don't stop arithmetizing under these scope of these things. So the way the semantics is going to tell you how arithmetic rules work is that they're not just going to be here in the local assertion context, but they're going to be preserved everywhere because we use these kinds of things in all of these kinds of contexts. So it turns out that the proof is going to be trivial because it's going to work in any of these kind of contexts, so we can pull it back to a priori knowability. So that's the way it would work, but then that gives you places you could stop if you wanted to argue about that.
The speech act part of what you were saying. I haven't completely understood what you were saying. But,
the problem is, I probably haven't either.
Well, no, but so obviously we use conjunctions in all kinds of speech acts, not just assertions.
Yes.
So, you know, we say, why did
yep.
you drink and drive?
Yes.
Or we say, if you want to stay dry and it's raining, don't forget your umbrella.
Yep.
You know, so we've got commands, we've got questions,
yep.
you know,
yep.
The whole panoply of,
yes.
of Austinian speech acts might involve conjunction,
yep.
disjunction or whatever. So what's the special role for assertion?
Yeah, that's a good thing. That's a really good question. What is the special role for assertion? The special role for assertion is that it's a handy way of describing some of the norms that are involved in such a way that you get something. You'll notice, firstly, this is a similar kind of problem for the truth conditionalist as it is for the proof theorist, because, and this is what Noor calls the declarative fallacy. is thinking that, you know, declarative sentences are, you know, the be-all and end-all of semantics. And I don't want to commit the... Pardon? Nor Belknap. Paper, declaratives are not enough. Phil Studies? Can't remember. Anyway, declaratives are not enough. And I agree that declaratives are not enough. I want to say, actually, that the kind of formal structure is going to be connected up with a bunch of norms. And whether or not the norms, the behavior of these norms can be described primarily in terms of assertion and denial, or whether these are all on a par together, is a really interesting question. But I want to say, for example, if you've got a proof, not only does it tell you that it'd be a mistake to assert the premises and deny the conclusion, but if you focus on a particular conclusion, for example, then the proof is going to be an answer to the, you know, is this the case question, where you've granted the premises and denied the other conclusions or something. And so that's going to connect it up with questioning and answering norms. And I think actually the right kind of response that you might want to give to the Achilles and the Tortoise Lewis Carroll objection about modus ponens tells you you don't want to just look at the norms of assertion and denial by themselves, but look at, you know, the connection between the rule of modus ponens and, you know, norms of question answering and other things like that. So I don't want to say that assertion and denial is the only thing that you can be focusing on. It's just an easy place to start because of that habit. But what I want to say, yeah, commands and other kinds of imperatives and interrogatives and a whole bunch of other things like that, yeah. I have a big research project which says, you know, years 3 and 4, I'll be looking at that, but I'm not up to years 3 and 4 yet.
I have myself on the list, and it's sort of a follow-up as well. So in the score sheet, as you were thinking about it, it seemed like the score sheet just had assertions and denials as the elements, and I kind of wondered whether you could put other things there.
I should hope so.
Sort of like, I mean, you could even put actions as part of the score sheet that you're
keeping
track of. I mean, there is an interesting difference between commands and questions on the one hand and assertions and actions on the other hand, and that's that we don't exactly hold people responsible for commands and actions.
Yep.
I mean, we can hold people responsible for the action of commanding or questioning, but with assertions, we hold people responsible we hold people responsible for their actions. So
same for a whole bunch of things. You know, different kinds of contextual features like you know, times, locations, things like that might be salient. Same for particular kinds of objects, which, because assertions, I think, the right kind of way to understand, you know, even that stuff that I said about quantifiers is really to say that rather than using eigenvariables or other kind of stuff like that, is to just say that, oh my God, we don't just assert, we make assertions of things. And in particular, when I'm talking about abilities or something, I'm saying he can, etc. There's a whole bunch of things that are going to be salient, and that's more grist to my mill. The richer that the structure is that we're going to be doing things off, and more things that we might make explicit, and say that, well, provided we're all keeping track of this stuff, there are going to be some things which are just formal, definable in terms of that, which are going to be structural relative to that.
Yeah.
So the more of that stuff, the better.
I guess I suppose the other notion you might appeal to is things for which we give and ask for reasons.
Yep.
As a way of categorizing the stuff that goes into the scorecard. I have David on the list.
Yeah, so we had some big picture questions and a small picture question. So about the alleged validity of the indicative if A, then actually A.
Yep.
So, so no problem with the formal stuff, but I take it that the logic of actually you're using is one where actually A entails necessarily actually A.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a weird... Because to the extent that actually A sounds the same as A, then it ought to be that, you know, it'd be cool to say, you know, it's raining, so it's actually raining, but you don't want to say, well, it must actually be raining. And it causes problems with the conditional, because just as if A then actually A sounds good, if A then it must
this
actually
is, this is the point at which
bad.
I'm going to...
It's worse when you contrapose it, even.
Yeah, this is the point at which I'm going to say, well, yeah, that's because must can be used in various ways, and things like this. This is a place where I'm going to say, look, if, I mean, if we use, and so, look, yeah, sure, who knows how we actually use must? But if you want to use it like this, this is something which is going to come out. No, I don't care. If it turns out that the logic of the actual logic of actually turns out to be more complicated, that's great. Then it turns out that, you know, using these kinds of rules as a way of analyzing what's going on for actuality, well, that's not great. I don't mind. This is not actually a proposal which says that this is how we use actuality. This is a proposal which says that, oh, look, if you were going to use these things in this kind of way, this is what's going to come out. And it explains why we might be able to coordinate, you know, on that. Now, it turns out, I reckon, that some of those worries that we have about this are as a result of confusing epistemic and other modalities. But that's another matter. Yeah.
You didn't go on to say it, but some people, like, it looked like it was suggested by the slide, you know, like Williamson wants to argue that, well, actually, the indicative conditional really is the material conditional, which is very, very close to it, because only such a conditional will get you the direction of actually that gets you this contrast. But if you're not committing yourself to whether we actually talk that way.
No, I mean, I think we don't even do that for knots and Boolean negation. You know, we don't even do that for... But that's all right, because I don't mind this being, you know, an idealization. Because if it is an idealization, then we want to say, well, look, what are the various purposes that we put modal vocabulary to? Well, does this precisification and this regimentation actually do some useful things? And, well, that's going to be an interesting kind of question, in the same way that I don't think that every use of not or all or some are those formal, you know, not or all or some, but they're bloody good, you know, regimentations.
Tom.
So I had a little question, a big question, I guess. So the little question is, even if it's a problem, like you'll have an easy addition. Just so can the syntax you're using, or the point some other way, account for cases where someone like me wants to not assert something and not deny it?
I should hope so.
Oh my God, yes.
It's not going to make you, it's not going to make you, you know, one of those boring people that have got an opinion about everything at parties. Well, it's not going to, it's not going to do that to me, I hope. Other things might have. It certainly doesn't do that. I mean, this is just formally, you know, identical to classical logical consequence. Classical logical consequence doesn't do that. Okay. You know, where did you think it made you assert or deny everything?
So I assume if you have excluded middle, then you're committed to saying that either I'm willing to assert P or not P, where...
All the reading that I gave you here said that P or not P, for that meaning of or and not, is undeniable.
Well, okay, so that's something the intuitionist can accept, because that's different.
No, it's unclear whether the intuitionist can accept that in the meaning of undeniable that I've given it.
Okay.
Because it's unclear. I mean, the way that denial and assertion, or deniability and assertability, interact with Kant, that's the point at which the intuitionist is not going to agree. But you don't have to be non-classical to be, you know, not opinionated about everything. You know, I can be ignorant about whether P or not P, in the sense of ignorant about whether it's P that occurs or not P that occurs, but still think it's undeniable that P or not P. I just don't know which. Right? Yeah.
So the bigger question was just in relation to how your account ties in with giving a principled account of what a logical constant is.
Yeah.
So here's one way of thinking about the question. Suppose you've got some language and you've got access to the inferences that speakers of the language are willing to make, and their intuitive judgments about syntax of the language. Does your account then give you a principled way of saying this word of theirs, where that's where the intuitive judgments about syntax come in, is a logical constant, and this other word isn't?
That's a good question. Not just from that, I don't think. Because are they correct about what they take to be inferences in their language?
Let's help ourselves to that. I mean, I think it's a super hard question, but I just thought I would ask you because I want an answer to this question.
Do you? Why?
Well, like, for example, I spent like the last week sitting around thinking about whether of is a logical constant.
Whether what?
Whether of is a logical constant. So you can just say blah, blah, blah of seems that you can do this, right, for any example you can cook up.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So does that show obviously constant? I don't even know, right, even if it's true that shows obviously.
Yeah, look, I was not, you know, that little stuff where I said, you know, what is a logical constant at the beginning, that wasn't a question that I actually answered. But what I gave, I mean, what I think is that logical constants is a family resemblance notion. And what I offered was, well, relative to some score-sheeting thing, then relative to that, the things which can be defined using defining rules of those things are going to be, you know, given various assumptions like the well-foundedness of the subformula property and a few nice little sanity conditions on rules, is going to be both conservative and uniquely defining, which looks like it's going to do a bunch of work. I didn't go through that here, but it's going to do all of the things that I wanted to do about being necessary in a certain sense and being formal and a bunch of other things like this. So it's offered as a deserver of the notion, but you'll notice that the stuff about score sheets and things is using a kind of third-person interpretive perspective on what's going on, saying what is the normative practice? What are the rules that are being used? And I can't see an answer to the question, what's a logical constant, which is going to be kind of interesting, which isn't going to make some assumptions about that kind.
If I could just follow up on that for a second. So I was wondering, and I'm kind of rushed you through the metaphysics stuff at the end, but I was kind of wondering how you see the issue about logical constants hooking up with the stuff about, like from Sellars, that the cosmodalities might be framework explicating notions rather than having descriptive content or empirical content. Do you think that in order to win that kind of metaphysical point, the relevant word has to come out as a logical constant in some way of...
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I don't... Yeah, these are hard and...
Or is just these being are, logical constant one way to win that point?
I don't know whether you win that point or not.
Okay.
I'm. But these are, you know, questions which are above my pay grade as a logician. What I do know is that... Because, look, suppose we, you know, introduce box in our vocabulary, if it's not actually a natural language word, and govern it like this, then... You can get a truth conditional semantics out very easily just by doing a completeness theorem. If you've got an invalid sequence, then, you know, force feed it, turn it up to 11, the Hankin construction, you get a possible worlds model by idealization. If you like, you're hypostasizing the positions in a particular way. Now, what's the point of doing that? Well, the point of doing that is to, you know, reflect the operator, box, diamond, and other vocabulary in terms of extensional quantification vocabulary, in the same way that, you know, doing this thing for arithmetic and getting models of, you know, mathematical theories and things like this is doing exactly the same kind of thing. And the question is then, what's the status of, you know, modeling in general? Is this kind of free ontology and stuff? So that's going to be the way that I'm going to go about this and say that, well, and this is how I'm going to put flesh on the bones of the, you know, hint I made about the order of explanation. So look, here's how. If, you know, your practice is like this, then here's something you can do relative to that bit of the practice, which is going to be like this. And then if you want to have an ontological, you know, truth conditional explanation, well, this is, you know, how you're idealizing a truth, and this is how you're going to idealizing at the structures that these things are true of. And then, you know, given that, you know, box P is true at a point, if and only if, you know, P is true in all of the accessible points in one of these kinds of models, you know, all you've got to do is, you know, actually jump in and endorse that construction, and then, you know, relative to that, you get the, you know, here's what a possible world is. That's one of those things. But it's you've got to endorse the kind of construction and, you know, introduce into your vocabulary that kind of, you know, mathematical guff or that kind of ontology. There is a question of whether you think it's free or not. I don't know. I'm a logician. My sense of costs and benefits are completely corrupt.
Well, with that, let's thank Greg.